Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Human Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So this is the last class of our 2020 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. It's on the Fire Discourse, or the Adita Pariyaya Sutta. This is one of the three, known as the Cardinal Discourses of the Buddha. It's one of the first three teachings he ever gave. The first was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where he set the wheel of truth, the Four Noble Truths, in motion. It was the first time it was presented in the world. The second sutta was the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, explaining the not-self characteristic. And then this sutta, which describes the arising of stress and suffering in the world through passion, or through taking life seriously. And if you look at these first three cardinal discourses, they relate directly to the three marks of existence. The Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is broadly a teaching on impermanence, and of course all three marks of existence. The Anatta Lakkhana Sutta is on that, the not-self characteristic, and this sutta is specifically on the nature of stress arising. And I think most of you were here on Saturday, so this is the second talk on this sutta. And I'm going to bring up a few different things that I didn't touch on Saturday, and right at the beginning, let me start the sutta. The Buddha was staying in Gaya at Gaya Head with 1,000 monks. Even that is remarkable. This is about a month or 2 months into his teaching career, and he's already gathered 1,000 followers. There he addressed those in attendance. Monks, the all is aflame. It's such an interesting reference that we start this out with. What all is the Buddha referring to, or what is the sutta referring to? And of course, in the context of the Dhamma, out of context of the Dhamma, you might think that the Buddha is addressing all things, meaning all of creation, everything we could possibly consider, kind of falling into that unity or one mind consciousness that people are so eager to grasp after. What the Buddha is referring to in the context is as the all is the internal manifestation of stress and suffering rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And we can see that clearly where the Buddha takes that reference to all. He's now addressing that through our physical senses. And so a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths uses the six sense base, five physical senses, and the sixth sense of consciousness, meaning ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, that simply reaffirms the reaction and responses to what's occurring, what's coming in contact with the sixth sense base. And because a mind is still rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, it can only interpret what's occurring from that viewpoint of ignorance. And so everything that follows from that is simply a manifestation of ignorance. So, monks, the all is a flame. What all is a flame? The eye is a flame. Forms are a flame. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. And contact at the eye is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. It's such an important line. In concluding that sentence with even, I just want to see the way, neither pleasure nor pain, meaning even those things that we are ambiguous about, inflame our passions. How could that be if we're ambiguous, if we're almost not even noticing it? Is because a mind that is prone to distraction, in fact, requires distraction to maintain views ignorant of Four Noble Truths, find that ambiguous state where nothing seems to be happening as boring. We need to find something. Something needs to take over my immediate consciousness to distract me from this moment. And of course, the Buddha's counter to that is jhana meditation. It brings the mind through that simple technique of being mindful of the breath in the body. Momentarily, at least, we bring the mind back in our bodies. And so we can notice this process of using our sixth sense base rooted in ignorance and recognize that process that we're doing. So you've heard me say over and over again, you've heard the Buddha say over and over again, the Dhamma is practiced right here, right now, in life as life occurs. And that's what this sutta is about. It's pointing us to be mindful of how we're either reacting or mindfully engaging with what's occurring. And so as we develop the Eightfold Path, and right view becomes the overarching view of how we live our lives, now we start to see things clearly in relation to right view. And so we're no longer inflaming our passions because of this sixth sense base that is rooted in ignorance. So I hope I gave that enough of a background to understand this now. The Buddha continues, aflame with what? Aflame with the fire of passion. The fire of aversion and the fire of delusion. The Buddha is referring to the three defilements, greed, aversion, and ongoing deluded thinking. The Buddha continues, aflame, I tell you, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, regrets, pain, distresses, and despairs. That's exactly how the Buddha describes suffering. He describes suffering in just that way. Birth is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Aging is suffering. Death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering. Getting what is undesired, what we don't want to, what we are averse to, is suffering. And he would always conclude that by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. He continues, the ear is aflame, sounds are aflame. The nose is aflame, aromas are aflame. The tongue is aflame, flavors are aflame. The body is aflame, tactile sensations are aflame. The intellect is aflame, so ideas are aflame. Consciousness at the intellect is aflame. Contact at the intellect is aflame. It sounds like a pretty grim picture that the Buddha's painting here, but all that he's saying is that if we continue to rely on our sixth sense base that is rooted in ignorance, the only thing we can hope to do is to live a life with our passions inflamed, always grasping, always rooted in desire, always rooted in the next thing that we need to continue to distract ourselves, either through pleasure, pain, or to find another ambiguous state where we're simply bored to tears. And then we'll react in different ways, won't we? The Buddha continues, and whatever there is that arises and dependent on contact at the intellect, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is aflame. I was going back and forth because I want to make a point here. What arises independent on contact at the intellect? Does anybody have an answer? Anybody can holler it out if you have. Whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, what is it? What is it that is dependent on arising with contact at the intellect? You can call it stress or suffering. You can call it, pardon me?
Fabrications.
A fabricated view of self is just what we're talking about. I guess Brett's having trouble. Let me let Brett get on here. I think Brett's having trouble staying logged in. So, you back in, Brett? So the Buddha's pointing out he's referring back to dependent origination, which states, and Kevin hit the head right on the nail, that from ignorance as a requisite condition, it's required, ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrication. And so immediately we start fabricating what we think is a self. And when that self is fabricated from our passions rooted in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, what are we creating? We're creating a human being who is prone to greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. It's not an accident. It's not an accident of birth. It's not an accident of bad luck or bad karma. It's not an accident at all. It's directly a result of the way that we think, which is the greatest freedom that we've, the greatest freedom in the world is to understand that in creation. Because if I can understand that the reason why I'm distracted and distressed and misunderstanding my life and my relationship to the world around me, it's simply because I'm lacking understanding of Four Noble Truths. That's what the Buddha teaches us. The Four Noble Truths teach us how to be a mature, fully awakened human being. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact that the intellect experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure or pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fire of passion, the fire of aversion, the fire of delusion. A flame with the three defilements. So, and this is, I'm putting a little bit more emphasis on this than I did on Saturday, because this is where we recognize, this is where we come in contact with the Dhamma from an unawakened state. It is obvious to all of us, as long as we have a measure of concentration, where greed or grasping or desire is arising. We know it. And if we just take a moment to quiet our minds down, we can see it. One of the reasons why jhana meditation works is because, again, it's a direct counter to that constantly grasping after what I need to be happy, greed, what I need to avoid, aversion, and the ongoing thinking that maintains that deluded thinking. That's the three defilements. That is what we recognize when we're mindful of passion. Because when I find myself getting reactive or in a recognizable way, grasping after something in this moment, we know what that feels like. With a mind well concentrated and framed by right view, in that moment, I know that I've lost my mind. And I know what to do. I know to take a breath, recognize the object of my desire is just that. It's an object of desire rooted in ignorance, and simply come back in my body and let it go. Take another breath. And in that way, I'm directly countering my own thinking that gives rise to these passions. In other words, it's not, this is the ehipasika part of the Dhamma that the Buddha is referring to here. It's not just enough to have an intellectual knowledge of how I cause greed, aversion, and deluded thinking in my mind, in my life. I also have to take the steps necessary to abandon the thinking that got me here. Again, meaning thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha continues, a flame, I say, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrow, regrets, pains, distresses, and despairs. Seeing thus, the well-instructed disciple of the Noble One grows disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with forms, disenchanted with consciousness at the eye, disenchanted with contact at the eye. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experience as pleasure, or as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, with that too, we grow disenchanted. So what is it that arises in dependence on contact at the eye? Not Kevin. Who's got an answer? With that too, we grow disenchanted. In a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, what is it that arises in dependence on contact at the eye? It's ignorance. Ignorance arises at contact at the eye from a mind rooted in ignorance. And with that too, this is such an important line here, with that too, the wise Dhamma practitioner grows disenchanted with ignorance. That would almost seem like an obvious thing, that once a human being recognizes ignorance, they would quickly abandon it. But we know that that's just the opposite is true. We talked a little bit on Saturday about this idea of creating worship over the things that we desire the most. And so we set our own ignorance up through the ideological attachments that we make and define ourselves by as a type of worship. And that's what makes it so difficult to let go of things, even though we know they are rooted in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, because they're so familiar with us. They're who we think we are, when in fact they're nothing. They're just a passion inflamed by ignorance. The stronger it is, the stronger our connection is. We know, as wise Dhamma practitioners, it's simply because of a strong connection, a strong familiarity with what's occurring. With that too, the wise Dhamma practitioner grows disenchanted. They grow disenchanted with the ear. They grow disenchanted with the nose, disenchanted with the tongue, disenchanted with the body, disenchanted with the intellect, disenchanted with ideas, disenchanted with consciousness at the intellect, disenchanted with contact at the intellect. And notice the progression here, because as we start, and I think every one of you would have recognized this, as you start your Dhamma practice, you're starting to develop a little bit more of a well-concentrated mind. So now you're starting to, you're beginning to be able to recognize the gross manifestations of ignorance. And as you continue your Dhamma practice, that level of recognition of ignorance gets ever increasingly more subtle. Yes, everybody understands that and has experienced it. And so ultimately that very subtle level of recognition is at the intellectual or at the thinking level. In other words, when we finally let go of all fabricated views, it's not an external object that we're finally reconciling. It's our views of ourselves in relation to the world. Remember the study we did last year, 36 weeks on introspective insight into just this one thing. And this sutta points to exactly the same thing. Where are these passions becoming inflamed or aflame? Within me. It's not occurring outside of me. There's nothing external that can address this. There's nothing external that can bring understanding to it, save the Eightfold Path and the direction that has me looking in and at my passions. Something that no human being ever really wants to do. And the reason why we have this structure and framework of an Eightfold Path is to overcome that natural tendency to avoid things that are familiar to us because they're us. It's a this sutta is a clear direction on take a close look. A few weeks ago, I quoted Jiddu Krishnamurti, who always said, look at the life you're living. That's what this sutta is pointing to as well. Look at the life we're living. What are the things that we're grasping after? What are the things that right here, right now, I don't want in my life? Those are the things that we're holding out in front of our awakening, to recognize them and abandon them. Come back into our body and recognize in the most subtle ways the things that are inflaming my passion and keeping me rooted in ignorance. Let me finish the sutta now. And whatever there is that arises independent on contact at the intellect experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, they grow disenchanted with that too. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. So we talk about dispassion often. It's not just something we decide to do, is it? In order to develop this passion, I must become disenchanted. And what am I becoming disenchanted with? First, it's the objects and events of the world. But ultimately, it's the object of my own ideas that I'm becoming disenchanted with. And if you take that to its most subtle level, I'm becoming disenchanted with my own notion of who I think I am. Because I formed those notions, those ideas of everything I thought I was, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so you've heard me reference a few times about the confusion I felt as a mid-teenager, 13, 14, 15 years old, because the world just didn't make sense. And there was no one at the time who could explain to me Four Noble Truths, and I probably was in no shape to even understand it. In other words, if the Buddha himself came along and tried to teach me, I probably wouldn't have taken to the teachings. But I'm still responsible for that, aren't I? The fact that the teachings weren't available to me then is no excuse. The truth of the matter is that I fell into the same trap that every other human being did because of the environment and because of a lack of understanding, that I believed my own fabrications. Even though as I was forming the, and this is one of the most significant things that I can reference now in relation to the past. I think it's one of the only things that's useful to bring in the past, which is a right view. I didn't have an understanding of the world I was living in, yet I had no reference or ability to gain that view. And so I was continually driven to adapt my view to fit what was occurring based on my initial ignorance. Is everybody following me? Yes or no? Am I too vague? And so we want to look for a root cause in everything. And so it's disappointing and unacceptable for most people to say, this is what occurred. But this is what occurred. This is what occurred in my life, in your life, in every other human being's life. There's no one to blame. The world isn't to blame. My parents aren't to blame. My teachers, nobody is to blame. It's not that there's a lack of an all-powerful knowing God. It's not the fact that there's not a Buddha alive in the world today. The reason why I have suffered a life of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, a life rooted to these three defilements, is ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so even though I wasn't aware of it, it was still feeding my frustration and confusion at 13, 14, 2 years old, 25 years old, et cetera, et cetera. So what's the difference? Well, a few years ago, I came across something called the Buddha's teachings, the Buddha's Dhamma, and I started learning about Four Noble Truths. And I started getting an understanding that it wasn't something that happened to me that is wrong with me. In fact, what I realized is that there's nothing wrong with me, except I don't understand Four Noble Truths. I'm not broken. I'm not lacking anything. There's not one thing wrong, except one thing, a lack of understanding. And as I develop that understanding, and I understand what the world is all about, I understand the greed, aversion, and deluded thinking that is inherent in having an entanglement in the world, I can develop disenchantment with that because I know what it does to me. It's the same as understanding. I better come up with a good one here. I'm going to use a gross example at first and then a more subtle example. It took me a long, long time. In fact, it almost killed me a few times. I was very close to physical death dealing with drugs and alcohol. And even though it was obvious to me, or at least it should have been, that I was very, very close to taking one more drink and one more drug that was going to kill me, I kept doing it almost to the point of death. And it wasn't until I was able to get a perspective on that and understand at a very profound level what I was doing to myself, and then gain the wherewithal within my own mind, which was a small measure of concentration in the beginning, to realize this is not something I want to do. And I made a conscious decision to live a different life. Now, this is very basic, and this was the beginning of the establishment of a mind that was able to grasp the Four Noble Truths. I first had to sober myself up. But that's another way of saying I first had to address the gross level of distraction in my life. And that's where jhana meditation or right meditation comes in. Because whatever your distraction or distractions that you're using to keep yourself rooted in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, it's the most powerful force that has nothing behind it. So I'm using the analogy of drug addiction, and I got to be careful because the type of addiction that I had kills millions and millions of people, and it almost killed me and killed a lot of my friends. So I'm not minimizing addiction. But from the other point of view, from an awakened human being, addiction, frustration, doubt, ill will, I'm bringing in the hindrances. All of that is simply a mind rooted in ignorance. And I can free myself up by developing knowledge of Four Noble Truths. I said I was going to finish the sutta and I want to do it. So let me continue. And if there's any confusion about what I just said, please remember and bring it up. Through dispassion, they are fully released. Through dispassion, first I become disenchanted with the things that I'm attached to in my life. All of them. And from that disenchantment comes dispassion. I'm no longer grasping at the familiar objects, events, and views of the world because I'm disenchanted. There's no desire left in me for it. That is the process. That's what I'm emphasizing. You could look at enchantment as craving and passion as clinging, those two aspects of the second noble truth. So disenchantment initiates, or enchantment with my ignorant self, initiates the ongoing process of clinging to those enchanted views. Enchantment is such a good word because enchantment signifies being mesmerized by something. Or Mesmer was a guy who taught a lot of hypnosis. That's where the word came from, mesmerizing. Confusing someone through that type of mental tricks. But we do it to ourselves through continued insisting on continuing with ignorance. But again, this is the process the Buddha taught us to overcome. He grows disenchanted with all of that. Disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, he is fully released. With full release, there is the knowing fully released. That's the ahapasika part of this. We know it. No one has to tell us, and no one can tell us that we are fully released. We know it for ourselves. He discerns, meaning they understand, that birth is ended. The integrated life has been fulfilled. The task is done. There is nothing further for this world. That was what the Buddha said and gratified those gathered. Their hearts were awakened. They awakened upon hearing that. That's the end of the sutta. The direction, the clear direction of this sutta is just so remarkable that it points to the thing that we're doing each and every moment in Dhamma practice, which is recognizing, what am I enchanted with in this moment? What's causing, what am I craving after? And so what am I clinging to? And we go through this internal process through concentration and through right view to recognize and abandon all those things. So that's tonight's talk. Let's go around the room. I think we'll start with Ram. Ram, how are you? Hello, Ram.
Unmute. There we go.
Where'd you go?
Yeah, I'm here.
Got it, the Ram.
Yeah. I don't really have anything right now. It's a cardinal sutta. At this point, I have so much going on in my head about it that I can't really say anything.
You did. I'm glad you joined. Brad, how are you tonight?
Good. Thank you for the teaching. I definitely understood what you were saying, and it's very helpful, and it was definitely, I could relate to it a lot. So, but as far as much to, I know how much you contribute to it, but thank you for your teaching.
I'm glad you joined too, Brett. Did you have trouble getting on tonight, logging on?
No, I was a little bit late because I was doing, I didn't think I was going to make it, and I was able to jump on. So
glad you made it.
I signed in late.
Tim, how are you tonight?
Good. Greetings, everybody. So the last bit that you talked about in comparing the, not comparing, but associating the disenchantment to dispassion as the clinging and craving.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel that, if I could add to that, how if enchantment is more of a mindset, a quality of mind, whereas passion is more of an emotion, a reaction. Would you tend to think that way as well? And so when you have disenchantment, your quality of mind is elevated, where you can become dispassionate. You won't have that reaction to that contact. You won't have that emotion. And
yeah.
So that's kind of how I always, when I see that in dependent origination, how I structure it, when I go back to what my quality of my mind is, am I enchanted or disenchanted with what's going on?
Yeah, that you're absolutely right. That's the way to see it. You know, the word enchantment is probably the best word to describe that quality of mind, because it's just, we enchanted ourselves with these things of the world. With what is really, I mean, there's nothing in the world that is permanent. And so nothing in the world has any inherent value, does it, except that which we give it. Like a pile of gold is useful to have because we can buy stuff with it. But when I self-identify with that pile of gold and I need that pile of gold to be happy, it's because of my enchantment with it. And there's the problem, isn't it? Because I'm enchanted with the value, then I become passionate about holding on to whatever it is. And of course, all those things there's nothing that has any value save the value we give it, or as a society, we decided it has a certain value, but it's still just a hunk of metal, isn't it? It's a great way to see it, Tim. Thank you. Matt, how are you tonight?
Hey, everyone. Good. Good to see everyone. Good to be here. Hi, Jane. So one thing that we've been talking about, and in particular in the sutta, the world is a flame. The world is a flame with the fires of passion.
Loka sutta.
So this, the flames of passion, or enchantment, or you name it, is craving. And so what the root of becoming is craving. So when we're becoming further ignorant, the root of that is craving. So again, when we'll go back a few weeks ago to dependent origination, looking at from contact comes feeling. From feeling comes craving and clinging. From craving and clinging comes, or from craving comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining comes becoming, further ignorant. So again, we're going back to the root of becoming as enchantment, passion, craving.
Yeah.
And disenchantment and dispassion, disenchantment leading to dispassion, is interrupting that constant sensory craving.
Yes.
So, and, you know, as this being one of the three cardinal suttas, the first two, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and the Anattalokana Sutta, are the two foundational suttas that set up how to look at craving and what is craving. And so, yeah, just...
Outstanding, Matt. The word that describes an awakened, fully mature human being is nibbana or nirvana. That literally means extinguished. That the root of that Pali word or Sanskrit word is extinguished, and it refers directly to this. It refers to putting out the flames of passion. So the Buddha described an awakened human being as just that way, as nibbana. They have put out their own fire of passion. Thank you for bringing it up, Matt. Hello, Julia. Hello, Julia. I'll do it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. How are you, Julia?
Very, very good. Thank you, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking.
I wrote this little thing that I just wrote down just now. Seeing and hearing alone could do nothing if not for the fabrication done by the mind. It is because of conditioning of the viewer's mind. The mind cannot be aflame without the fuel of craving and ignorance of impermanence. But that's what I have. I feel like it's part of the passion being inflamed comes from the fact that we crave for things that are impermanent, in an impermanent environment that do not really exist. And so that's the way I see it. I don't know if that's correct, John, but...
Yeah, it is. Just the utter brilliance of understanding that. Why should I crave after? Why should I create an identity or a life grasping after things that are completely fleeting, no matter what it is? You know, even if it's making enough money so I can go buy a mountain somewhere, I bought something that at some point is going to be gone, no matter how much I want to hold on to it. And there's nothing in the world that we can put or establish in a way that makes it worth losing my mind over, is there anything? And so we understand that as Dhamma practitioners only because we have teachings like this that can show us what is the right view. How am I supposed to look at the things of the world and the relationship I have with that? save for a right view. And you pointed that out beautifully, Julia. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Michael, how are you?
Hi, John. Hi, everybody. This is the way I understand this. And I think the, I hope this adds some clarity to it. But the whole nature of this is impermanence. And to understand impermanence, understanding that the world we live in is impermanent, a phenomenal world, and also understand deeply and clearly with insight is that we are impermanent. So we're impermanent, and the world that we exist in is impermanent, where our ego is trying to sustain this, you know, make permanent something that is impermanent, and identifying with anything and everything that'll enable to feel that way. However, that's not the case. So once the understanding of impermanence is understood from our own perspective and from the perspective of seeing the world as impermanent, we have an ego trying to sustain itself in impermanence, and that ego self trying to sustain itself in an impermanent world creates a futility, because there's no way for the ego self to sustain itself in an impermanent world. This creates a this enables us to become disenchant. Well, the disenchantment comes through knowing that we are impermanent. That enables us to draw back and see that person that I used to be is trying to sustain himself or herself in an impermanent world. And this makes us almost feel, we learn compassion from this point in time. And we understand that that person used to be us. So now, with just a little bit of understanding, we're able to, you know, to learn compassion and draw back and understand how important the concept of impermanence is to us understanding and have right view of the Four Noble Truths and the three marks of existence and the aggregates. All of these things become, we see them now through what's known as profound right view, I would imagine. Wouldn't we say that, John?
Absolutely.
That's my understanding of it. Maybe not so eloquently put forth, but that's the way I see it and understand it.
That was outstandingly eloquent. How's that for putting a word onto it? Really, think about it this way. What is the defining characteristic of an ego personality? Anyone? Defining characteristic of an ego personality.
Ignorance.
Yeah, that is one, but it's not the one I'm looking for. Think about your ego personality 3 years ago and think about it today. Yeah. What's a defining characteristic?
Impermanent.
Yay! And so here we are living a life trying to take something that we think is us, our ego personality, and make it permanent when it itself is impermanent and we know it. We know it changes moment by moment. And we're trying to establish that in an environment that can't hold it. An impermanent environment. It is when you see it clearly, when you see it from right view, it's a simple matter to stop that process, isn't it? Because we realize the utter ignorance of trying to do that. It's just an ego personality. It's something that I created. And whether it served me well or not. And so, this came up actually yesterday from someone that brought this point up, that this ego personality that we're, to use the words, it seems we're so eager to get rid of something that has at times served us well. It's true. We've all done sent things through this ego personality that were useful, helpful, compassionate, maybe even beneficial to us as far as paying a mortgage or putting food on a table. That's all part of having a human being. But that ego personality is not capable of understanding what it is. That's the problem. And so I can have a much more meaningful life by understanding what I am in this life that I'm having. That's the point of what the Buddha taught. And in a very real way, Michael, that's what you were pointing to. So thank you. Trevor, how are you tonight?
Hi, John. Hi, Daniel. Everyone.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. Yeah, I was thinking it'd be helpful for me if you'd deepen a bit on, I know we've talked about it before, but definition of consciousness seems like it's being contrasted with intellect in this sutta. And I know we've talked about consciousness as basically thinking, but it seems a little bit perhaps different from the intellect, which I associate with thinking, which makes me start to wonder if consciousness is more about holding attention than it is about our thought life or our ideas. Would you say more about that?
Yeah, I mean, they're really the same thing, but in the, as I'm teaching the sutta, let me put it that way, the intellect does refer to, in general, the ongoing way that human beings think. There's an intellect. And so the consciousness would be more specific to the individual who has a consciousness that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So that's probably not a very satisfying explanation, but they really are kind of the same thing with a very subtle difference. One is more of a generality, and one is specifically talking about when we're using the word consciousness in relation to the Dhamma, it's ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And the important distinction is that as people that grew up in this, in an always grasping after a romantic view type of human evolution, meaning this idea of consciousness always growing and getting bigger and evolving. Well, there might be some truth to that, but as far as it relates to the Dhamma and ignorance, it's the same type of thinking that we've had for 2,600 years and before that. It's simply, as the Dhamma is concerned, it's ongoing thinking. As far as the Dhamma is concerned, consciousness refers to ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So does that help, Trevor?
That helps. Thank you, John.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Jane, how are you?
Hi, John. I'm fine.
Good to see you.
Good to see you and everybody. What I've noticed is as my practice deepens, it's easier for me to recognize my ignorance.
Yeah.
And it might just be subtle little things or big aha ignorance, oftentimes triggered by something a Sangha member might say. And so that's what I've noticed.
Thank you. While you're talking, I was thinking back over my life, and I realized that for the great portion of my life, I wasn't ignorant of anything. It's only when I came to the Dhamma that I found out how ignorant I was. I'm glad I did. Tom, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, I was feeling very at peace, and then I got just while you were speaking, I got an email that came through, and I double booked an important business call at this same time. And that made me momentarily feel anxious, and it just shows how it just reminded me of how the path, or you know, the Dharma path is so. Just when you think you've had a meditation and you feel like, oh, this is I've got this down, and then one little thing happens, and you're like, ah, damn, and you're stressed, and your mind is distracted. So anyway, but I'm obviously I'm annoyed about missing that meeting, but I super appreciate this time, and I wouldn't have knowingly booked that meeting at this time anyway, because I really appreciate this chance to connect with everyone and to listen to your teachings. I have one question, but backdrop. I was watching this documentary on YouTube, the Planet of the Humans. It's a Michael Moore documentary. It's just come out. It's free to watch on YouTube. It's quite interesting. It's all about, anyway, the response to climate change. And the interesting perspective I found was we're holding out for all of these sort of green initiatives, right? Like different forms of solar, wind power, et cetera, as being our savior. And yet it looks a lot at those different industries. But basically the message from the film that I took away anyway was that we cannot hope to respond in any kind of responsible way to climate change without fundamentally changing our lifestyles. Again, this comes back to your teachings, John, where it's just, not your teachings, the Buddha's teachings, but what I picked up through, the clarity of that message this morning is it's just ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, which leads us all around the world onto this crazy sort of hamster wheel of craving and wanting more and consuming more and et cetera, et cetera. So I really have that clarity on the teachings. And, you know, there's so few of us who are, I mean, I consider it a privilege to be able to really interact with these teachings and to learn, you know, to know about them. But what about, in watching this documentary, I just saw that urgency to sort of share the Dharma with more people. But I also don't want to come across as some kind of Dharma evangelist too much, right? And annoy people. I'm talking to a friend at the moment, and he's like, "Oh, I like the idea of it. It sounds good," but he just wouldn't meditate. And I'm getting frustrated because I'm like, "Man, you need to actually do it. You can't just think it's a nice philosophy and then whatever. Like the impact happens through doing." So, what advice do you have? I mean, I'm sure you've come across this many times, right? People that maybe find the philosophies of Buddhism or the Dharma interesting, but they're just not going to, they're not willing to actually do anything, or at least they're not at that stage yet. How do you deal with people, like that? Or how do you try to sort of, what's the best way of encouraging people? And there you go. That's my question.
Thanks, Tom. Just as far as representing the Dhamma, that's best done simply by example. And so because of my position, the website, books, etc., people do come directly to me with questions, and some people end up being students, and some of those actually end up continuing practice. But the great majority of people aren't really interested in something that requires actual change. And so very quickly, and you'll, when someone tells me I'd like to learn from you, but I'm not going to meditate, I very nicely say it's just not going to work. It's not worth either one of our times to do that, because it requires meditation. And so the only thing that I can do is to answer questions directly. I have told people that I don't think the Dhamma is for you because of the things that they've told me. Again, just to be honest and straightforward about that. But people that are really interested, it's just this. You have to do this. You have to do what we do. There's no shortcut. And then to get back into what you were talking about a little bit, this was never meant to be a salvific religion. The Buddha never saw himself as a savior. He didn't teach other people to think of themselves as saviors. He taught us to practice the Dhamma and to not contribute to the world's ills. Excuse me. So, and I know you really weren't going this far with it, Tom, but I'd like to address it. The issue of climate change and the theories and schemes that are put together to hopefully counter it are all part of the First Noble Truth. And so that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned about what we're doing to our planet. We should, but we shouldn't lose our minds over it. Because if we do, if we react out of ignorance, and we might even create wonderful movies, but that are still rooted in that ignorance, meaning they over-exaggerate something, we're only contributing to the ills of the world. So as Dharma practitioners, we have to be very, very circumspect about what we're doing, and we use the Eightfold Path to define our activities in the world. In other words, if what I'm doing is framed by the Eightfold Path, it will cause no harm to other people. And that's the most important thing. So over the years, there's been all kinds of theories that are put out and all kinds of schemes that people should do. Some of them were helpful, some of them weren't. The point that I'm making is that the ultimate responsibility that the individual has to the planet is the same responsibility that we have to awakening, because it will lead to the same things. So you often hear me say, maybe not you, Tom, because you started coming just recently, the most loving thing we can do for ourselves and for all other sentient beings, the greenest thing any human being can do, is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. So if we're really concerned, and we should be, if we're really concerned about the state of the world, wake up. That's the best thing anybody can do. Because you'll, and that doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing other things. But if we're really concerned about other people, wake up. It's the best thing we can do. Thanks, Tom. Kevin, how are you?
I'm doing well, John. Just to follow what you were saying there, I think that this sutta, and to follow what Matt said, the three cardinal discourses, there's sort of a unique chronology there. You know, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta presents sort of maybe a context of anicca, and anatta is presented clearly in the Anattalakkhana Sutta, how we personalize the world through an impermanent world that we don't understand through Four Noble Truths. And then resulting in this talk, the Buddha sort of explains, you know, they know they're fully released. You know, when you've experienced that release from the flames of passion, from the flames of the world, you know, we simply don't do it anymore. We don't light ourselves on fire. We release the ignorant views, the fabrications. And as other suttas have said, there's a joy in that release. And that's why we keep going. And I appreciate everybody on this path with, you know, with the enthusiasm they bring. And it's really a great pleasure to be here with all of you. So thank you.
It sure is. Thank you, Kevin. Tim, you had something that you want to talk to about rebirth. Does it fit in with our talk, or should I end the session and we can talk about it off camera or off recording?
Off recording.
Okay. So our retreat begins Friday night. I think most of you are signed up. There'll be information in Thursday's email about it. I think that's all you need to know. We're going to start at 7 o'clock on Friday night. The schedule's on the website. You'll need the password BBCRMC to get in. And please, those that are joining us, just come try to get there 15 minutes early before the scheduled start time, so we can settle in and do that. I think we have three of the four other teachers here tonight too. I'm really looking forward to hearing our four teachers present on this retreat. It's really going to be remarkable. And the sutta itself is just completely apropos for right now. The theme is taking true refuge in the Buddha's Dhamma. And we're going to develop that nicely over the six sessions. So I think that's it. We'll does anybody have any questions or comments about our class tonight? Okay, let's finish with metta and then I'll end the recording. We can hang out a little bit. So find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes. Gently close your mouth. And just take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Excuse me. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being at any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.